Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to update a story that I've been following for quite some time, namely the very firm indications that, quote, UFOs, unquote, or, quote, flying saucers, unquote, are very real and have been around for a long time, but that they do not come from outer space, but have been developed right here on Earth. Now, I can appreciate that that would appear to be utter madness to members of the listening audience, considering the way the story has been played, but there are very firm indications that circular and other unconventionally shaped aircraft of high-performance capabilities have been around a long time, that they were developed during the closing stages of World War II, primarily by the Germans, and that, in fact, such contemporary aircraft developments as stealth technology and vertical takeoff and landing technology are part of the lines of aeronautical R&D which gave rise to the so-called UFOs. In fact, when radar came into widespread use during the Second World War, the search for aircraft that would be refractory to radar, which bounces its signals off of right angles, became a top priority of aeronautical research and development, so that aircraft pressure to develop aircraft that avoided right angles became one of the central focal points of military research and development during World War II. The indications are that that vertical takeoff and landing technology and conquering the boundary layer gave rise to the so-called UFOs or flying saucers. One of the things that I think is important about this story from a political standpoint is that the spin being put on that story is either it's a bunch of nuts, it's figments of their imagination, it's pilots mistaking the planet Venus or a weather balloon on a bright night, or else it's the other extreme. It's, you know, space aliens from Uranus, our brothers from space and ETs and all that hocus pocus. Because of that, I think that the human race, and the United States in particular, are very vulnerable to the utilization of these aircraft for some sort of monstrous psyop, because UFOs are real, and the indications of that continue to grow, but they don't come from outer space. The ET part is the okey-doke. I've discussed that in a lecture entitled The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth, also in three pairs of half-hour segments done in 1997 that are available from Spitfire. I would also point out that in July of 1997, an article came out on Popular Mechanics magazine, and it talked about the importation of Nazi scientists at the end of World War II under Project Paperclip, something I've discussed in numerous broadcasts, and that so-called UFOs, unquote, appear to have been developed by the United States in the aftermath of the Second World War, utilizing some of the technology imported from Axis aeronautical developers at the end of World War II under Project Paperclip. And again, the deliberate manipulation by elements of our national security establishment of the ET myth, and the ET thing is just exactly that, a myth, and the technological development of, quote, UFOs, which is real and quite well documented. Again, all of that in three pairs of half-hour segments available from Spitfire, as well as the aforementioned lecture available from Spitfire entitled The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth. If some of the supplemental discussion to what I'm about to read seems somewhat abbreviated or inadequate, I can appreciate that. Please get a hold of the relevant tapes that I just alluded to flesh out your understanding of what I'm about to talk about. Very important development vis-a-vis the whole UFO question emerged in the San Jose Mercury News, among other newspapers, of Monday, June 29th of 1998. The following is an article by Michelle Levender, Levander, and it's headlined, Science Panel Says It's Worth Evaluating UFO Reports. And the article reads in part as follows. For more than 50 years, UFO investigators have scoured the skies for signs of alien life, completely snubbed by the scientific community as cranks. But today, in the first independent scientific review of UFO evidence in nearly 30 years, scientists gave a faint nod in their direction by concluding that it might be worthwhile to evaluate UFO reports, marking a major and important shift in the eyes of some UFO investigators. Well, I think this is a very significant article. It remains to be seen what comes of this, if these, quote, scientists, unquote, and I'm not casting aspersions on them, I don't know who they are, if they come out with the whole ET, you know, space aliens from Uranus nonsense, then this will be destructive. If, however, they begin to study the UFO phenomenon in a sincere and objective fashion, it could lead to the clearing up of this issue and the dispelling of the myth that these aircraft, one, are either imaginary, or two, are produced by some otherworldly civilization. They're real, but they don't come from outer space. They're made right here on Earth. For people new to this concept, just take into account the Frisbee, which is a recreational toy which you've all seen used. A Frisbee is a circular airfoil, and it flies. The notion that the human race, with all of its incredible technology, couldn't make a flying circular airfoil just doesn't compute. It's a no-brainer. In fact, they have, and they've been around for a long time. They have been covered up, however, through spin control. They've been seen by all kinds of people all over the world for more than a half a century, but it has been kept under wraps via spin control. This article, again, from it appeared in many newspapers on June 29th of 1998, may signal a change in the scientific winds vis-a-vis the UFO phenomenon, and I think politically that's very important. Bear in mind that in a poll taken last year, more than 40% of American college graduates, that's college graduates, believe we have been visited by extraterrestrial civilizations in UFOs. That makes this whole question very important from a political standpoint. If more than 40% of college graduates believe that, that is significant. And it's important to clear up the myths concerning that, because the UFOs are real, the space aliens aren't. And if people believe these things come from outer space, those devices could be used to put the human race on its knees. The following article belongs in a category that I've used on this program for quite some time that I call Food for Thought and Grounds for Further Research. I'm not stating necessarily that this article is in any way connected with the article that I just read, but the fact that it appeared a couple of weeks, just more than 2 weeks later, has led me to wonder. And this concerns the death within a four-day period of three of the German rocket scientists that were brought in to work on the U.S. defense program and the U.S. space program under the auspices of Project Paperclip. The following comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, July 14th of 1998. Again, this is the Mercury, Tuesday, 7/14/98. It's an AP story, Dateline Huntsville, Alabama, and headlined, German Rocket Team Members. And it's the obituaries of M. Novak, M-O-N-O-W-A-K, H. Pates, P-A-E-T-Z, and A. Schuller, S-C-H-U-L-E-R, aided U.S. space program. It reads in part as follows. Three members of Wernher von Braun's German rocket team that helped put Americans on the moon died during the past week in Alabama. Max Novak, N-O-W-A-K, 89, of Huntsville, Heinrich Pates, 88, of Grant, and Albert Schuller, 83, of Huntsville, were original members of von Braun's team of engineers who developed the V-1 and V-2 rockets during World War II, and then came to the United States under contract to the Army. They worked on the U.S. rocket and space program, eventually for NASA. Quote, "They were all three highly respected for their capability and their knowledge," unquote, said Ernst Stuhlinger, S-T-U-H-L-I-N-G-E-R, von Braun's chief scientist. Mr. Novak died Tuesday, Mr. Pates died Thursday, and Mr. Schuller died Friday. All three died of natural causes. Well, all three gentlemen were old. They were all in excess of 80 years, and certainly old people do die. We all die, and old folks obviously pass away more readily than others, given their reduced state of health. Nonetheless, the fact that all three died within a four-day period in the same state does lead me to wonder. It is certainly possible, given their advanced age, that all three of them might have croaked within 4 days. However, simply from the standpoint of mathematical probability, that is unlikely. What I'm wondering is whether perhaps some of these scientists knew something about some of the development of UFOs, and there are firm indications that, quote, flying saucers, unquote, were developed by the Germans during the closing stages of World War II. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And I wonder, and this is pure speculation, but I wonder if the decision on the part of some scientists that it was now worthwhile investigating the UFO phenomenon in a serious way has occasioned a cover-up or a sanitizing operation. Again, this is what I call food for thought and grounds for further research. I'm not saying this is. I'm asking, is it? It is certainly possible that all three died of natural causes within 4 days of each other by coincidence. They were old. But from the standpoint of mathematical probability, that is possible, but unlikely. And again, that from the Mercury News of 7/14/98. The reason why the deaths of those three Project Paperclip Nazi rocket scientists in a four-day period led me to ask some questions about whether that might be connected to the decision to investigate UFOs from a serious standpoint is that indeed there are firm indications, as discussed in, among other programs, the lecture about the UFO phenomenon that I did in 1992, and a half-hour segment, a pair of half-hour segments done in July of 1997, that in fact UFOs are real and that they were derived from experimental German technology during the closing stages of World War II. A very important article, which in turn is a review of a book, has appeared in the Searchlight magazine's issue of August of 1998. Now, the Searchlight is a British anti-fascist publication, not to be confused with the American Spotlight, its ideological opposite number. Similar names, dramatically, totally different, ideologically opposed perspectives. The Searchlight's issue of August of 1998 and other issues of the Searchlight can be obtained from the following address: 37B as in boy, New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, that's London, William 1 Mary 8 Jolly Roger, and it's ISSN 0262-4591. The email address for Searchlight is editor@slight.demon.uk, editor@slight.demon.co.uk. They have a worldwide website, www.slight.demon.co.uk. That's www.slight.demon.co.uk. Their phone number, by the way, 0171-284-4040. And in the August 1998 issue of the Searchlight, there was a very, very important article which has reviewed a book, which reviews, I should say, a book about the Horten brothers, Weimar and Walter Horten, two of the aviation, German aviation pioneers who appear to have been behind the development of so-called UFOs or, quote, flying saucers, unquote. And the work of the Horten brothers was discussed in the Popular Mechanics story from July of 1997. This article was entitled By the Searchlight, Fleeing Nazis and Flying Saucers. And the introduction to the review reads, Simon Matthews reviews The Horten Brothers and Their All-Wing Aircraft by David Myra, M-Y-R-H-A, published by Schiffer Military and Aviation History, 1998, available by mail order from Midland Publishing Limited. And the article reads, Simon Matthews is presently writing a book about Nazi science, Rare Chosen Minds, on, quote, The Nazis, Their Phenomenal Technology, and Its Use After 1945 by Britain, the USA, and the USSR, unquote. Since the war, a fringe cult has grown among Nazis who have propagated the idea that the Third Reich actually developed flying saucers. In some versions of the story, these machines have been hidden on the dark side of the moon or under the polar ice caps. While this is Nazi mania run wild, Simon Matthews has uncovered the true story of the post-war development of aircraft that looked remarkably similar to those flying saucers seen on cinema and television screens, not on the dark side of the moon or in the Arctic, but in Argentina, the USA, and elsewhere. This last sentence again. Simon Matthews has uncovered the true story of the post-war development of aircraft that looked remarkably similar to those flying saucers seen on cinema and television screens, not on the dark side of the moon or in the Arctic, but in Argentina, the USA, and elsewhere. More than 50 years after 1945, fresh material on the diversity, savagery, and super technology of the Second World War continues to appear. A surprising amount can be found by trawling through the mail order catalogs of aviation, military, and other fringe publishers. The Horten brothers, aviation pioneers in Nazi Germany, now have their story told. By the way, Horten is H-O-R-T-E-N. Continuing, biographer David Myra from North Dakota and described as, quote, a veteran of field intelligence who crawled through the swamps of Southeast Asia for his country and himself and later worldwide as a part-time member of the U.S. intelligence community, unquote, has had unique access to their personal papers and memorabilia in both Germany and Argentina. The photographs are magnificent. Myra charts how glider clubs rebuilt German nationalism after 1919 and shows the willingness to look at unusual aircraft designs, in this case, quote, flying wings, unquote. Reimar and Walter Horten had friends at every level of the Nazi hierarchy: Ernst Judit, Erhard Milch, Hanna Reich, Willy Messerschmitt, Hans Ulrich Rudel, and, ultimately, Hermann Göring. By the way, Hannah Reich was a female and very accomplished German test pilot, Hitler's personal pilot, or one of them. Hans Ulrich Rudel was a much decorated Stuka pilot and one of the post-World War II leaders of the Kameradenwerk, one of the elements of what I have termed the Underground Reich. Hermann Göring, of course, was head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, and also the Reichsmarshal of the Third Reich. By the way, you're going to see and hear a name here, Adolf Galland. Adolf Galland was in charge of all fighter forces for the Luftwaffe during World War II. Continuing with the text here, speaking of the brothers Reimar and Walter Horton, after combat experience with Adolf Galland, they were put to work designing a supersonic, streamlined fighter. Completed in December of 1944, it resembled a flying dinner plate. These last two sentences again, because they're critical. Speaking of Reimar and Walter Horton, after combat experience with Adolf Galland, they were put to work designing a supersonic streamlined fighter. Completed in December of 1944, it resembled a flying dinner plate. Göring then snapped them up to build his, quote, America bomber, unquote, huge, transatlantic, almost invisible to radar, and designed to drop Germany's atom bomb on Manhattan. Mira helpfully provides a vintage map of Ground Zero. After 1945, Britain and the USA grabbed most of the Nazi scientists, including war criminals, via Operation Paperclip. Several fine investigative historical works have appeared on this topic in recent years. By the way, some of the books, first of all, there's Project Paperclip by Clarence Lasby, published by the Athenaeum Press in 1971. There's the Paperclip Conspiracy by Tom Bauer, and also Secret Agenda by Linda Hunt. Those are some of the references. Continuing. Mira provides fresh information about how groups of German aviation specialists stayed together and gives details about the famous, quote, rat lines, unquote, the exit routes out of Allied occupation. By the way, the rat lines were discussed in RFA 17, available from Spitfire. Continuing. The original plan was to dispatch a large contingent led by Kurt Tank to China to assist Chiang Kai-shek. This was dropped in 1947 due to the unexpected resilience of Mao Zedong and his communist forces. Instead, helpfully, into the gap stepped Juan Perón, fascist sympathizer and dictator of Argentina. Mira provides great detail on how the, quote, rat lines, unquote, worked. The fleeing Nazis exited to Argentina either via the Argentine embassy in Copenhagen or via the weekly Argentine Air Force flight from Rome to Buenos Aires, stopping at Madrid, Morocco, Senegal, and Rio de Janeiro. Embassy staff provided fake identities and passports. The story ends with Reimar Horton in Argentina working on aircraft design even after the fall of Perón, and Walter Horton in Germany helping relaunch the Luftwaffe in 1955. Mira uncritically accepts the brothers' views of themselves as neutral technocrats. This airbrushed approach quickly collapses. We see photos of Walter Horton in jackboots and steel helmet, paying homage at the shrine of the Nazi martyr and Freikorps activist Albert Schlageter. This was not a simple visit to a war memorial as suggested in the text. By the way, the Freikorps were the paramilitary bands that paved the way for Hitler's rise to power by systematically assassinating the political opposition in Germany. That discussed, and among other programs, RFA 10, available from Spitfire. Skipping down, whatever the book's value in historical or social terms, Mira leaves many, mainly political questions unanswered. Why did so many aircraft specialists congregate in Argentina? Why did so little emerge from their activities? How did Perón pay them? How did they fit into the Skorzeny network of hardcore Nazis and disgraced collaborators, De Wattwin, Pavlich, and De Grel? One feels the shadow of Bormann and Schacht in the background, together with the suspicion that Perón's real motive in keeping this skilled group together was as part of a larger insurance policy by the West to maintain an offshore expertise bank that could be reactivated in the event, thought to be very real in 1948 through 53, that World War III might break out at any moment. But this is speculation. Mira and the Horton brothers have brought us a step nearer piecing together the jigsaw of the post-1945 diaspora of the Nazis and their fellow travelers, as well as illustrating the obsession of the Third Reich with novel technology. And again, this article from the Searchlight magazine's issue of August of 1998, and it's issue number 278. And I think this is a critically important article. One wonders whether perhaps some of the UFO development was being conducted in Argentina under the auspices of the Underground Reich, including the Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I've spoken about in past broadcasts. Again, this article, Fleeing Nazis in Flying Saucers, by Simon Matthews, reviewing the book The Horton Brothers in Their All-Wing Aircraft, by David Mira, Schiffer Military and Aviation History, 1998, available by mail order from Midland Publishing Limited. Two of the key sentences again, by way of emphasis. Simon Matthews has uncovered the true story of the post-war development of aircraft that looked remarkably similar to those flying saucers seen on cinema and television screens, not on the dark side of the moon or in the Arctic, but in Argentina, the USA, and elsewhere. And skipping down, speaking of the brothers Horton, Reimar and Walter, after combat experience with Adolf Galland, they were put to work designing a supersonic, streamlined fighter. Completed in December of 1944, it resembled a flying dinner plate. Flying dinner plate? Flying saucer? Hello? This, again, by the way, Searchlight magazine can be obtained by 37B as in boy, New Cavendish Street, C-A-V-E-N-D-I-S-H, London, William 1 Mary 8 Jolly Roger, and then there's SSN 0262-4591. I don't know what that refers to. Telephone 0171-284-4040. Fax 0171-284-4410. Email editor@slight.demon.co.uk. And their worldwide website, www.slight.demon.co.uk. One of the reasons I think it's very important to penetrate the myth that, A, UFOs don't exist. They do exist. They've been around for 50 years, and there's a growing body of documentation pointing that out, is that this has been portrayed as, again, either the figments of imaginations of kooks or else our brothers from space. That's what I've termed over the years, space aliens from Uranus. Well, UFOs are real, and if people ever see them, they should be very careful not to mistake these as otherworldly phenomenon. If they make their appearance, they will not be your brothers, and they won't be from space. And again, I think the vulnerability of the human race to some sort of psyop, which would take the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast several steps further, is one of the reasons why the lid has to be lifted off of this technology. A listener researched the following article for us, and I think this in many ways exemplifies the spin that's been put on the whole UFO question. A listener got this from the Tico Times of Costa Rica of July 3rd of 1998. This is an article by Catalina Calderon of the Tico Times staff. It's headlined, UFO Contactee Story Now Out in English. And this concerns a book called UFOs, A Great New Dawn for Humanity, which has been put out by a researcher named Enrico Castillo, who was an electrical and communications engineer born in Costa Rica of a Colombian family. And I would note that his general geographical area of operations was in Latin America, and it was in the southern part of Latin America that the brothers Horton, among others, were doing their work in the post-World War II period. I wonder whether perhaps the presence of the brothers Horton in Latin America had something to do with the, quote, UFOs, unquote, that Mr. Castillo says he saw. Notice the spin on this, however. Speaking of Castillo, his unusual experiences started in 1963 in Costa Rica when he watched two, quote, oval and orange flying machines, unquote, move about the crater of Irazu volcano, which had been erupting ash for months. As an engineer for the Costa Rican Electricity Institute, or ICE, he and two colleagues were placing an observatory post to monitor possible lava flows when the unexpected event occurred. Quote, my co-workers saw them too. We were as if paralyzed and felt sick immediately afterwards, but decided not to tell what we saw because we knew people would think we were crazy. It was 1963, Castillo recalled, adding that sometime later the other two witnesses decided never to tell the story, while he started to look for information about UFOs, of which he hardly knew anything. The 21-chapter book details Castillo's further experiences with the extraterrestrial phenomena, among them his first encounter, quote, of the third kind, unquote, when ETs are physically present in a spaceship above a lagoon north of Bogota, Colombia in 1973, and meeting again inside another such craft, a humanoid he'd met years before in Caracas, Venezuela, who had a human appearance and claimed he was a Swiss named Cyril Weiss. Now, notice the spin on this. They're automatically presented as extraterrestrial phenomena, yet the brothers Horton, by December of 1944, had developed a supersonic jet fighter which resembled, quote, a flying dinner plate, unquote. And again, flying dinner plate, flying saucer. And notice it says here on another spacecraft, and he met a humanoid he'd met years before in Caracas, Venezuela, who had a human appearance and claimed he was a Swiss named Cyril Weiss. Well, this highlights the spin that's been put on this story. I would suggest that Castillo may very well have had an experience with a real flying saucer, not from outside of this Earth, not piloted by space aliens from Uranus. And the notion here that this humanoid, whom he'd met years before in Caracas, Venezuela, had a human appearance and claimed to be a Swiss named Cyril Weiss, I would suggest that Castillo may very well have been inside a real flying saucer made right here on Earth, and that the creature that he saw was a person using the name Cyril Weiss, perhaps of Swiss extraction. But again, notice it's a humanoid with human appearance, and it's a spaceship, an extraterrestrial phenomena. This highlights, I think, the very dangerous spin that's been put on this altogether critical question. It's also interesting, though not necessarily significant, that that, quote, humanoid, unquote, was alleged to be a Swiss national named Cyril Weiss. In the aforementioned half-hour segments recorded in July of 1997 and available from Spitfire, I discussed one of the fascistic UFO cults, namely the Raelians. The Raelians espouse a totalitarian system of government to be run by, quote, our brothers from space, unquote, in which all democracy and all earthly military institutions would be disposed of, and we would just allow ourselves to be ruled by, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. One of the reasons why I think the reality of UFOs needs to be exposed, and they do not come from outer space, and they are not run by, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. This cult, the Raelians, was based in Switzerland and was one of the first organizations licensed to clone human beings. An article about them appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, August 7th of 1997. This is an article by Alif Kaban, K-A-B-A-N, of Reuters. It's datelined Saul Kanan, Switzerland, and headlined Cult Embraces Human Cloning and Free Love. It reads in part, members of a Swiss-based cult that wants to clone humans has begun a week of sensual meditation and cosmic orgasm, unquote, in the shadow of the Alps. Outsiders were not welcome at the gathering of some 500 followers of a Frenchman calling himself Raël, a journalist turned sect leader who says humans were created in laboratories by aliens and claims 35,000 followers in 85 countries. Skipping down, despite Switzerland's staid international reputation, the Raelian group is not the only offbeat organization to call these alpine valleys and mountains home. The same mountains were home to the Solar Temple, which gained international notoriety after mass suicides and murders, killed 53 of its members in two Swiss villages and a Quebec ski resort in 1994. I've dealt with the Order of the Solar Temple in the past, and not only was it connected to Licio Gelli, the former Waffen-SS officer who headed the P2 Lodge, it also had been founded, Solar Temple, that is, by a former Gestapo officer named Julien Origa, and had apparently done work on behalf of various Western intelligence agencies. And there's a pair of half-hour segments about the Order of the Solar Temple available from Spitfire that discusses that. And again, people who would like to flesh out their understanding of the Order of the Solar Temple, a subject we'll come back to later, should contact Spitfire for that information. Now, I've made many allusions to Spitfire, including the various tapes about the UFO phenomena that are available. Again, those tapes, a lecture done in the fall of 1992, entitled The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth, and six half-hour segments done throughout 1997. Spitfire can be contacted at P.O. Box 1179, Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. That's capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That concludes this segment. Thanks for listening.